and welcome to the Tudor Her Story. Today I am talking to Dr. Elizabeth Norton about Anne of Cleves, Henry VIII's fourth wife. Hi, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's an absolute pleasure.
So today we're talking about Anne of Cleves, but I thought first we could talk a little bit about yourself and your illustrious career. So first, I thought we could ask, what was your first experience of Tudor history?
Oh, I don't know. So I always loved history as a kid. I was that sort of geeky kid who was always reading the history books and watching all the programmes. I mean, actually, when I was a kid, I got the BBC's Henry VIII Six Wives series out of the library on video. And that was really, I think, probably my first exposure. And it's that great series where it's got Keith Michelle, who for me is Henry VIII. I mean, if I ever had a time machine and I went back in time and Henry VIII wasn't Keith Michelle, I would think that was wrong. But it has a different episode for each of the six wives, and it's incredibly low budget. The sets really wobble, and everything seems to take place in sort of one room of a palace. But they're just so great and really inspiring. So I think it's probably that series, and it was old back then, but it was, you know, it was just so much fun to watch it.
I love that series. My mum said that's the series that made her love Tudor history.
Yeah, it's just fabulous. And they made a movie of it as well, and it's not quite as good. This series, each individual episode is just so interesting and so much fun.
I think you can tell what's Hollywood and what's the UK.
Yes. Yes, I know. I mean, honestly, and it's the same with Elizabeth R with Glenda Jackson, which is sort of the follow-up. And again, everything takes place in pretty much two rooms. You know, you think, guys, you just needed a bit more budget, but it kind of doesn't matter because it just takes you into it.
No, absolutely. So would you say that is what made you fascinated in Tudor history and you wanted to pursue it more and more?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was always very into the kings and queens. You know, I could sort of recite the English kings and queens and British kings and queens when I was a kid. And yeah, so I think it just made me want to read more and more. And I used to read some historical fiction when I was a teenager as well. But generally, I was reading the nonfiction. And I kind of just thought, actually, I want to do this. It's really interesting. I want to find things out.
No, that's me, but sadly it's with the Tudors, which is controversial.
See, the Tudors is it's great because it got so many people interested in the Tudors, and it's not great because actually it does take some liberties. I mean, I always think Henry VIII would be very, very pleased to be Jonathan Rhys-Meyer at the end of his life, to be honest. But it's great because it gets people interested. And, you know, people who watch the Tudors think, I want to read more about it. I want to find out more about my favourite characters. And that's fabulous. I mean, I honestly don't really have a problem with the Tudors. I mean, I'd slightly watch and think, that didn't happen. But, you know, actually, it's a bit of fun and it does get people reading and researching. And so I think that's a positive.
No, I try to justify it when anyone's like, wow, the Tudors, and like, yeah, I'm sorry, but it got me into it, so.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It's, you know, it's fun and it's glossy and glamorous, but it actually, you know, it does kind of, it gives you a sense of what it was like living in a dynasty. I mean, quite scary often at times.
Yeah. When do you think you knew you wanted to make history a career?
I guess I kind of always wanted to, really. I mean, you know, I always wanted to write books. My mother is a children's writer, so I was in a kind of, I grew up with books and people writing books. So it was kind of never really, it was something that was always possible, I suppose. You know, it's whether you can make history a career, that's more of an issue. But it's, you know, actually, yeah, I guess always, really. Again, as a teenager, I was always reading the nonfiction books and sort of thinking about things.
Oh, that's really nice. So, obviously, we started talking about Anne of Cleves. So, early years for Anne, who was Anne's family?
So, Anne is German. And of course, Germany isn't united in this period. It won't be united until the 19th century. So, it is under the aegis of the Holy Roman Emperor, but it's quite loose control. So actually Germany is made up of a series of sort of small principalities, dukedoms, counties, which are semi-independent, but by semi actually quite independent. Her father is the Duke of Cleves, and actually her mother is the heiress to Julius, which is a neighboring duchy. So this is a point really where Cleves becomes quite large. They're quite, you know, I mean, compared to England, very small scale states. Cleves has always punched above its weight in the marriage market. However, I mean, you get princesses of Cleves sort of popping up all over Europe. There's one in Spain, for example, in the medieval period. So they're definitely royal, a very, very high birth. But you know, she is of lower status than Henry VIII, because he, of course, is a crowned king. But yeah, so she grows up in Cleves, with her parents. She also has an elder sister, Sibylla, who marries the Duke of Saxony, and she has a younger sister, Amelia, and she has a brother, William, who is, of course, the heir.
Amazing. I think it's often overlooked that Anne had quite a royal background. I think she's just seen as a duchess, isn't she? She's much more than that.
Absolutely, she's very highborn. I should just say with names, we had a discussion beforehand about whether we were going to call her Anna or Anne. And I know whichever way we went, people are going to shout. So it's really Anna. As you know, in Germany, she's definitely Anna. When she comes to England, it's anglicised as Anne. She does use Anne as a signature when she's queen. She goes back to Anna again for a bit. So it's kind of a mixture, but you can kind of say either. But yeah, she's absolutely royal, impeccably well born. She's quite closely related to the kings of France. She's related to the Holy Roman Emperor, absolutely of royal background and of royal birth. So she is, in that sense, she is certainly a suitable bride to marry Henry VIII. She may not be born to a king, but she is definitely of royalty. And we see this in England and in Britain in sort of the 18th and the 19th centuries, where they're all taking their spouses from sort of small German principalities, because they're absolutely royal. She's undoubtedly a princess.
No, yeah. So, would you say Anne had a very strict upbringing as a child?
Yes, so her mother is quite a devout woman, raises her daughters pretty strictly. This comes out in the English sources, so the English ambassadors who are trying to suss out what Anne of Cleves is like, you know, basically say she's never far from the Duchess's elbow, so she is quite strictly raised. Her mother is a very religious woman. There's also, she's not very well educated, and of course Henry VIII's court, it's become incredibly fashionable to educate women, and that's really a generation younger than Henry, or two generations younger, but he does expect his wives to be quite well educated to some extent, to be musical, to be able to dance, and actually Anne is literate. She can read and write, but only in German, so that's a disadvantage, because of course Henry can't speak German, so they don't have a common language. She also can't sing, and she can't dance, and she can't play an instrument. She just hasn't been taught, because she's so strictly raised. And these are disadvantages at the English court.
So, obviously, she had a very strict upbringing. Also, under her mother, would you say she was a Catholic? Because obviously, it's mistaken she was Protestant.
Yes, and this is a very, very common misconception, and actually one that I often say is the thing that sets my teeth on edge most of all. Anne of Cleves is most definitely not a Protestant, and is never a Protestant. So you'll see claims that she's reconverted, you know, back to Protestantism, or you know, she's converted to Catholicism. No, she's always a Catholic. But Cleves is quite reformist. So Erasmus, the great humanist scholar, has been quite influential in Germany, and particularly in Cleves. So her father has very much taken an interest. So he is quite reformist. So in fact, quite similar to Henry VIII in piety, actually. So Henry VIII is often said to be a king, you know, a Catholic without the Pope. And that's not quite the case. He does tinker with the church, but he's certainly not a Protestant. And we can see that in Cleves. Anne's mother is a devout Catholic. And throughout her life. So I think we can safely say that Anne is a Catholic, albeit within a Christian humanist tradition, so quite reformist in her faith.
Okay, I hope the listeners have had that myth debunked for them now.
Not a Protestant.
Not Protestant, because it does wind me up. Because I'm like, no.
It's awful, honestly. It's because she's German, and of course Martin Luther is German, and you know, her brother-in-law, the Duke of Saxony, is, I mean, he's definitely a Lutheran. But Anne is a reformist Catholic, a Christian humanist.
Would you say that Anne had quite a sheltered life? You know, she not worldly, but didn't go to court often.
Yeah, I mean, she will not have gone very far in her childhood, because of course Cleves isn't that big. So you know, she's within this duchy, or the kind of combined duchies of her parents. She is kept very closely. She's expected to you know, behave impeccably. She won't necessarily come to court very much. And again, actually, the English find it very difficult to even get a look of her. They complain about the monstrous habits that Anne and her sister Amelia are wearing. So, you know, all the clothing and the veils and the hats they're wearing, they can't even really get a look at her. So
Did
she is very
have any
sheltered.
betrothals in her childhood before Henry VIII?
Yes, she is betrothed to Francis of Lorraine, which is a good match. He's a member of the House of Guise, but of the senior branch. They are dukes, but sort of princely dukes, so it's quite a good match. Interestingly, actually, and this often doesn't really get pointed out, and it should, he actually will later marry Christina of Denmark, who is Henry VIII's sort of first choice for a bride. So again, sort of just shows the small worlds that Anne and Francis are betrothed, and they then go off and marry each other, someone who's been rejected by Francis goes off to marry a rejected bride for Henry VIII.
That's quite interesting. I didn't know that. That's quite nice. Why do we know why that marriage didn't happen, or did it just not go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, it's a childhood betrothal. They don't have a very high success rate, because of course you have to wait till the parties are old enough to marry, because until they're old enough to actually consummate the marriage, then it's voidable anyway, even if you do marry children formally. So it just falls by the wayside. As far as Cleves were concerned, it was validly broken off. The English obviously argued that that was not the case. However, again, it was never raised with Francis's marriage to Christina that there was a problem that he'd been betrothed to Anne of Cleves. So it is a bit of a pretext. It simply just sort of falls by the wayside.
Ah, interesting. Another one to add to my notebook later, or purchase your book, which I might have. So, when do we know when Henry set his sights on Germany, and specifically Anne?
Yes, so Henry starts looking for a bride, even before Jane Seymour is buried, actually. Jane Seymour dies, his third wife dies in October of 1537, on the 24th of October. And within weeks, the feelers are going out across Europe to try and find another bride for him. I mean, Henry may not actually be actively involved himself, to some extent, it's Thomas Cromwell taking the initiative. He first looks to France for a bride. And is specifically trying to marry Mary of Guise, who's engaged to his nephew, James V of Scots. But nothing really happens in France. There's kind of a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. He's assured that France is a warren of honourable ladies by the King of France. In fact, actually, he then suggests that maybe all the French princesses could be brought to Calais so he can go and have a look at them and choose his favourite. And that causes quite a lot of offence, actually. Francis of France says, with the king likes to try the women out as well, and which causes Henry to blush. So he then moves on to an imperial bride. This is slightly trickier because, of course, they're related to Catherine of Aragon. Christina of Denmark, who is his imperial choice, is Catherine of Aragon's great niece, the granddaughter of her sister Juana. Actually, it would be quite difficult because they'd need a dispensation from the Pope because of Henry's marriage to Catherine of Aragon, which Henry, of course, denies ever existed. But he chooses Christina, and he spends most of 1538 negotiating to try to marry Christina. She's the emperor's niece. He's promised her a dowry, so she's the imperial candidate. She's actually famously the woman who said that if she had two heads, one would be at the King of England's disposal. So she's not terribly keen to marry Henry. And finally, the negotiations founder because France and the Empire make peace with each other, and of course, then both turn and look at England and think, you know what, we're not very happy with you. So Henry doesn't have any allies and he needs to get some fast. So he turns to the Schmalkaldic League of Germany, which is a Protestant defensive league aimed effectively against the emperor. And one of its leaders and one of its founders is John Frederick, the Elector of Saxony, and he's Anne's brother-in-law. So Anne is put forward as the Schmalkaldic League's candidate. Cleves isn't a member of the Schmalkaldic League. They're a Catholic state. But obviously, she's the sister-in-law of John Frederick. So
Do we
they've got a
know
close
how
alliance. So she's
felt
felt
at
to
this
be a good enough
period? You
candidate
know,
to
obviously
ally
it's a
Henry
big
with the
change for
Germans.
her. Do we know how she felt?
So we don't know exactly how she felt because we've got no sort of sources actually where she describes how she felt. We can sort of posit a guess. I mean, Henry VIII is not a well-renowned husband by this stage by any means. It was believed, it was quite widely believed. Christina of Denmark certainly had heard that he poisoned Catherine of Aragon. And we know, of course, he didn't poison Catherine of Aragon, but that was certainly widely believed. He certainly beheaded Anne Boleyn, and that's widely known. Everybody knows he's beheaded a wife. And there are also rumors that he has caused Jane Seymour to die in childbirth through lack of keeping in the childbirth. Or there are also rumors she's been forced to have a cesarean section. Again, not true. But it doesn't make Henry look like a good husband. He's also considerably older than Anne, 20 years or so older than 20 years. He is not in great shape, although she probably won't have seen a portrait of him because it's actually felt that the higher status party shouldn't have to display themselves with a portrait. And it probably wouldn't have helped anyway, because obviously portraits are quite flattering usually. I think we can imagine that Anne is worried about Henry. She later refers to Anne Boleyn's fate when she's been told that Henry has doubts over her marriage. So she certainly knows what's happened to Anne Boleyn by June 1540. And I think it's unlikely that she wouldn't know what has happened to Anne Boleyn before the marriage occurs, because of course, it's going to be talked about. It's the talk of Europe. So I think she's probably quite apprehensive. However, on the other hand, it's actually an incredibly good marriage for her. Really good marriage. She'll be queen. She's in her mid-20s by this stage. She's kind of slightly on the shelf. She in her mid-20s? Yeah, coming up to her mid-20s. So she's slightly on the shelf. Amelia will never marry her younger sister. So, there aren't suitors beating a path to their doors. So actually, equally, it's a really good marriage for Anne Cleves. It will give her status. She'll outrank her sister, her elder sister, for example. To the extent that Cleves agree a really high dowry with Henry, and which he agrees he won't actually claim, but just to show how prestigious the marriage is. So I think we have to balance the fear of being married to Henry VIII against actually the status of being Queen of England.
Would you say, I don't know if it's just in my head, that although he wasn't about to have a fourth marriage, that it wasn't uncommon to be on your fourth wife in this period?
Absolutely. We tend to think of marriages as being long if they don't end in divorce. And of course, you can't really divorce in the 16th century. But actually, people drop dead all the time. So the average length of a marriage isn't necessarily that long. So yes, no other post-conquest English king has more than two wives. But in some respects, that's kind of luck. Philip II of Spain will have four wives, for example, later in the century. It's not that uncommon, particularly with childbirth, because women die quite frequently in childbed. In fact, two of Henry VIII's wives were Jane Seymour and Catherine Parr. It's not that unusual to be on your fourth wife.
Sorry. When did the preparations begin for Anne to leave Germany?
So negotiations take place throughout 1539. And the marriage contract is finally signed in September, and then it moves pretty fast to get her to leave Germany. And it's a bit difficult. Henry's a bit concerned that he won't get safe conduct because Cleves is mostly landlocked. Her brother's just acquired, under quite dubious circumstances, the Duchy of Guelders, which does have ports. So conceivably, she can be brought by ship, but it's a long and quite dangerous journey. So certainly in Cleves, they favour the land route, but Henry is concerned that if he can't get safe passage for her, then she risks being kidnapped. So that takes a bit of negotiation. She does get her safe passage, and then she sets out and crosses Europe and ends up at Calais.
What did the preparations look like for Anne?
So she'll need a trousseau. So she'll be expected to bring her clothing. And we know she has a very rich wardrobe, all unfortunately in German fashions, which are considered very unfashionable in England at the time, where the English follow the French fashions. And actually, we can see it in Anne's portraits. German dress does look quite old-fashioned compared to this quite racy dresses women of Henry's court are wearing. They're quite low cut, and they've got their French hoods where you can see their hair. Anne looks quite frumpy. Even though her dresses are incredibly rich, they've gone to town. They've really spent money to make sure she looks good, but they've used the wrong tailors. As well as that, she has to appoint or have appointed ladies to attend her. Henry's actually sent an English woman to her in Germany to teach her some English, so she'll also be practicing her English before she comes. And she does quite quickly become fluent in English. So she does trying her best to learn. But of course, you know, that's some months down the line, and she's certainly not fluent during her marriage to Henry. So she needs to have a household to attend to her. Her brother needs to finalise the arrangements with the English as well, you know, the handover as well, because obviously the gentlemen of Cleves aren't going to, not most of the escort aren't going to come into England with her. And some English escorts are also sent, most meet her at Calais.
What did the route look like? As I was definitely not trying to figure it out the other day.
Yeah, so she basically goes through part of Germany, up through the Low Countries, crosses northern France and ends up at Calais, which is an English town. Calais has been English since the 14th century, and you know is very English at this stage. Henry has a palace there, for example, so she stays in his palace, the Exchequer.
How long did it take for Anne to get to England?
So it takes quite a while, but mainly she's sort of slightly kicking her heels in Calais because obviously she's there in December, and the weather's really bad. And actually, the channel crossing, I mean, we're kind of used to being able to just nip across the channel if we want to. You know, it takes a few hours at most, but in the 16th century, it takes at least a day usually to cross the channel, and that's really quite a good crossing. The weather's awful, so she's waiting in Calais. And she shows herself very well. She actually asks some of the English gentlemen to teach her a card game that the king likes so that they'll have something to do together, which is very sweet. And she's also very willing. Eventually, the English actually come to her and say, look, you know, the weather's been awful. If the weather breaks, can you just be ready to go immediately and we'll just hop on the ship? And, you know, they think she'll say no to that. And actually, she's like, yeah, that's fine. So she's quite willing, but it does take quite a long time to arrive in England. They finally arrive at the end of December.
Was it a safe passage from Germany, or was it a bit treacherous?
So she has her safe conduct, so it's pretty all right. I mean, it's not brilliant. I mean, Henry is involved in quite a hostile situation with the French and the Holy Roman Emperor. Her brother is in dispute with the Holy Roman Emperor over guilders as well. So it's not brilliantly safe, but with the safe conduct, it should be all right. And, you know, if you've issued a safe conduct to a rival king's fiance, actually, if you then kidnap her, that's going to look pretty bad. So it's not too bad. I mean, the weather's not great. It's quite a long way. They're particularly worried about her complexion on the ship, actually, that the sea air will destroy her skin, which is interesting. She just needs to keep the portholes closed. But yeah, so I mean, it's not too bad. It's quite a long way. It's certainly the longest journey that she will ever take. And it's the longest journey that, you know, most people would ever take. It's really quite far.
When Anna did arrive in England, Anna, however you want to say it, when did she first meet Henry?
So she lands at Deal in Kent, spends a little bit of time in the castle there, and then moves on to Dover. And it's quite a well-trodden route up from the seacoast to London. So you stop at Dover, you go to Canterbury, you go to Sittingbourne. Sittingbourne's actually the only place which doesn't have a royal residence, so the royal party will stay in an inn. And actually, again, this just shows how amenable Anne is, that when it was looking like she was going to hit Sittingbourne on New Year's Eve, which would be a disaster because she's going to have to spend New Year's Day in an inn, she actually agrees to travel through awful weather to make sure she gets to Rochester for New Year's Eve. So she's at Rochester on New Year's Eve, and Henry decides that he is going to go and meet her in secret, which proves to be a bit of a disaster. There's an established tradition of courtly love that, you know, the betrothed will have this bond of love between them, even though they've never seen each other. And so Henry decides to go disguised as a servant, and so believes that Anne will know who he is instantly, and that they'll fall into each other's arms, and it'll be very romantic. And clearly does think he's in love with her. He's fallen in love with her portrait, and really likes this romantic idea of Anne as this sort of damsel in distress. So he goes disguised and hands over a letter to Anne, and she completely ignores him. She's just looking out of the window, at sports in the courtyard below, and just completely ignores him. Eventually, he tries to embrace her, and she just seems to have frozen, just completely doesn't know who he is, isn't interested in him, and he's absolutely crestfallen because it's gone horribly wrong. He then leaves the room, puts on a purple cloak, which is the signal that everyone can now recognize him. And of course, when he comes back in, everyone falls on their knees. And then Anne realizes that this is Henry. And it seems very polite, and they chat together. But the next day he leaves as soon as the tide has turned. And he actually has forgotten to give her her New Year's present. And so it's pretty clear that it's gone a bit wrong. I mean, he should have learned from history, really. His great uncle Henry VI had attempted to do the same when his bride Margaret of Anjou arrived, and she actually completely ignored him and just kept him on his knees while she read a letter. So Henry really should have known that this wasn't going to work, and possibly been a bit more astute that this kind of quite large squire, who everyone's been quite deferential around, has come in. I think possibly she should have thought, especially when he embraced her. Because of course, a man isn't going to do that to the king's fiancée. But I think really Henry is just, he's just upset. It's not gone right. And the thoughts of romance have just disappeared. She's not this romantic figure that he was hoping she would be.
Do you think this is what set the marriage to be bad?
Yeah, I mean, it's the worst possible start. Henry will complain that Anne is not how she's described, and there are complaints. He'll later say that she smells, and that, he doubts her virginity, and he can't bear to consummate the marriage. But actually, interesting. I mean, Holbein, who paints the portrait, and of course Holbein is one of the greatest portrait painters that has ever lived. Holbein is not punished for misrepresenting Anne to the king, so there's no real suggestion that the portrait isn't a good likeness, and Holbein always does good likenesses, as far as we can tell. So it may be that it's painted from quite a flattering angle. It's painted, she's facing full forwards, which is really unusual for a woman in the period. So I think Holbein has probably found her beauty, found the best angle. But I think she's not bad looking, really. I mean, we can look at other portraits as well, and there's nothing really to suggest that she's not good looking. She'll later complain that she's better looking than Catherine Parr, and people don't disagree with her. So I think actually the meeting is the problem for Henry. It's sort of crushed these dreams he's had. He's quite an unusual royal husband in that he likes to be in love with his bride, which most kings of the time really don't care. And actually he's picked all of his other brides himself, even Catherine of Aragon. He's chosen her and has believed himself in love with her, as with all his other brides. So I think they just don't have the chemistry, but I think a lot of that is to do with the fact that she rejects him so comprehensively when they meet. And it's really unfair because she doesn't know it's him. But that's really not how Henry sees it.
After this meeting, did he try and stop the marriage from going ahead?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Henry is very keen not to have to marry Anne. He talks about having a great yoke to enter into. So he instructs his, so he lets her continue with her journey, and she has a big ceremonial official meeting at Greenwich, and it all goes very well on the surface. I mean, Hall's Chronicle, Edward Hall, who's present at the court but not an insider, very much talks about how, they appear to be in love and how lovely the meeting is. But of course, behind the scenes, Henry's really trying to get out of it. So he instructs his ministers to delve into Anne's betrothal to Francis of Lorraine to try and find a way out. But actually, everyone from Cleves is prepared to swear that it's been broken off, even Anne. So they can't get out of it. And Henry can't fall out with the Schmalkaldic League as well. So he's already fallen out with the Emperor. He's already fallen out with the King of France. If he falls out with the Schmalkaldic League, he's got nobody as an ally. So he has to marry Anne, but he's really not keen.
When did they get married and what did their wedding day look like?
So they get married at the start of January in Greenwich, and it's Henry's grandest marriage. Most of his marriages are quite clandestine. His marriage to Catherine Parr is a bit bigger, and he invites some family. But actually, with Anne of Cleves, it's a big court occasion, and they're gorgeously dressed. Both the royal couple, they get married together. They then obviously have a banquet, and then they're ceremonially put to bed together to consummate the marriage, because you can't have a valid marriage without consummation. They have to have sex. They have to sleep together.
Once they are married, do things start to pick up for them, or is it just bad?
It's just bad. It doesn't get any better. And of course, there's going to be no kind of pillow talk, because they can't speak the same language. They don't have a common language. So that's quite difficult. Henry does attempt to consummate the marriage on the wedding night, but in the next morning complains that he felt her breasts and her belly and was concerned that she wasn't a virgin. He just couldn't proceed. So he is unable to consummate the marriage, and he does continue for more. They do try. So they sleep together for quite a few nights. But both will confess that that the marriage isn't consummated. There is actually an account by some of Anne's ladies in waiting, including Lady Rochford, actually, where they say they have a discussion with her a few months into the marriage, where she says, you know, she tells them that the king, that she's not still a virgin, because the king comes to bed and kisses her good night, and then kisses her in the morning to say, you know, good morning. And they say to her, well, I don't think we're gonna have a Duke of York anytime soon. It's an interesting account. I'd like it to be genuine. Problem is, Anne of Cleves doesn't speak English, and none of these women speak German. And Anne certainly doesn't speak English at the end of her marriage. She still needs an interpreter that summer. So actually, I think it's really unlikely that this discussion ever happened. I'd kind of like it to have happened, but it probably didn't. I think Anne, it's really unlikely Anne was that innocent about what was going to happen in the marriage bed, because it's a mother's duty to inform, even quite a religious woman like her mother, it is a mother's duty to inform her daughter of what is going to happen. And certainly Anne has German ladies with her who really should have been filling her in. So I think most likely she does know that there's a problem in her marriage. She does seem to have tried to get in contact with Thomas Cromwell, which suggests that she's concerned. She also starts to dress in English fashions, you know, wearing a French hood, for example. So I think she is quite aware that things are not going well and that their marriage isn't consummated.
Do you think, even though she knew there was a big problem, she still was a queen? You know, she played it very much to the fullest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's definitely the queen. I'm really good at it as well. You know, we her accounts from when she was queen survives, and she signs them all off as Anne the Queen. You know, she appears in court as queen. She's running her household. Yeah, she's absolutely the queen, and she just never really gets a chance to do it. But she probably would have been a really good queen. She certainly knows how to behave on a sort of a royal level. So, you know, you could definitely take Anne with you to go and meet foreign dignitaries, for example, and she'll certainly know how to behave.
When did Henry VIII start looking for a way out officially again?
So I think he's always kind of looking for a way out. The political system, the political situation disintegrates during their marriage, and the emperor actually goes to war with Anne's brother over Guelders, which is a disaster for Henry, because he's now looking like, rather than Cleves helping him out, he's going to be drawn into a war to help out Cleves. He's also become attracted to Catherine Howard, who is one of Anne's maids of honor, one of her ladies in waiting. And Catherine is very much playing the Anne Boleyn and the Jane Seymour card, you know, saying, I'm too good to be your mistress. So Henry would also like to remarry. But it's really in the summer, in June, that matters come to a head. And Anne is actually abruptly sent to Richmond Palace. And it's on the pretext that there's plague in London and Henry wants to keep her safe. But it's noted that Henry doesn't leave London himself, which is fairly good evidence that really he just wants to get rid of her.
Who was sent to Anne to tell her that the king wants to divorce you and it's been investigated?
So Anne, some of Henry's council are sent to her at Richmond, and they actually get her out of her bed. She's told in the middle of the night. So her chancellor, the Earl of Rutland, is sent for. Still needs an interpreter. So they use an interpreter. It's probably Wyman Carew, who's a member of her household. And Carl Haast, who's the ambassador from Cleves, also hears what's happening, and he hurries over to Richmond as well. And he becomes her closest advisor through this. And actually, his accounts are great. It's Carl Haast's accounts that give us Anne's point of view, because the English sources are quite different to Carl's. So the English claim that, you know, she's kind of okay with it. You know, she's a bit shocked, but she says, yep, that's fine. The marriage can be investigated. Carl Haast, of course, talks about the fact they arrived in the middle of the night, but also, you know, he says that Anne tells him that she's frightened, that, you know, she has to agree because she knows what's happened to Anne Boleyn, and she's very, very worried and very frightened. And I think Carl Haast's account is likely to be more genuine, actually.
Was Anne willing to be divorced? Do you think she saw it was more sensible to be a divorcee?
No, I think she was horrified. And that's the sense you get from Carl Haast's dispatches. Being repudiated by your husband is about the worst thing that can happen to an aristocratic or a royal woman in the period. I mean, it's absolutely shameful. So I think actually it's an awful thing to happen to her, and she certainly wasn't willing. However, unlike Catherine of Aragon, she doesn't have a child to protect, and I think she does choose the pragmatic path over resistance, because actually Henry's going to win whatever. So you might as well go along with it. And she does go along with it. In private with Carl Haas, she's upset, very upset by the annulment of her marriage. She's particularly worried about what her brother will say. And at first, she actually refuses to write to him, saying actually to Haas that she thinks her brother will have her killed, for the shame that she's brought on the family. So no, and this is another of the sort of myths about Anne of Cleves, that she's this sort of, she's perfectly happy to be rid of Henry. Actually, it's a disaster for her. And I think it's more of a testament to how impressive a character she is, that she actually does make a success of life post Henry, and she builds a life for herself. Because, yeah, as I said, being repudiated is awful, because it very much reflects on her status. She can't really marry again. Who's going to marry her? She's in this really ambiguous position. She's technically the king's sister, but of course, she isn't really his sister. And it's just really shameful for her.
No, completely. She truly is one of, she is the true survivor of
Yeah,
Henry VIII's wives.
absolutely. And again, she's not happy to be rid of Henry. I mean, she probably, on a personal level, I imagine she's not too bothered to not be married to Henry. But on a kind of a status level, it's awful for her. So she is absolutely the true survivor. She's very clever in how she handles Henry. She seems to have sort of hoped he'd take her back after Catherine Howard's executed, which is interesting. She's very disgruntled by the Catherine Parr marriage, because again, she wants the status of queen. But she's absolutely, she, I mean, she's the last survivor anyway. She lives until 1557.
In her divorce settlement, what was she given, what properties, etc.?
So Henry is so glad to be rid of her that he pays her off quite well. So she receives Richmond Palace, which is a fully royal palace. In fact, the king's father dies there. In fact, Elizabeth I will die at Richmond Palace. So, it's a proper palace. She also receives Bletchingley Palace, which is one of his smaller places, Bletchingley Place. She receives Hever Castle, which he's acquired from the Boleyn. She receives Penshurst Place in Kent at one stage. She receives a huge number of other smaller properties to use for rental income. So she's very, very wealthy, because Henry is trying to buy her off. And actually, we can see that he's trying to buy her off, because actually, in the terms of the annulment settlement, she only gets this if she stays in England. So she can't go back to Cleves. So the English very much put it around that she's chosen to remain in England. But actually, she has to stay in England. Her financial settlement is dependent on it. And the reason for that is Henry doesn't want her to go back to Germany and complain to her brother about how she's been treated. Or, perhaps even go to the emperor. And say, actually, I've been treated really badly by the king, and I'm his true wife.
Post marriage to Henry VIII, was she always in favour with him? Was it an amicable relationship from then on?
Yeah, they get on quite well. Actually, he goes to dine with her at Richmond on a few occasions. Actually, he always goes to tell her personally when he's remarried, which is quite a nice touch, I think. She comes to court. She comes to court while he's married to Catherine Howard, actually, and they also get on quite well. He tops up her pension. Inflation hits very hard in the 1540s, so actually, the value of her pension goes down, and she spends a lot of money. And he actually does top up her pension, so he pays off some of her servants, gives her some extra cash. They do get on quite well. On the other side of the coin, she's being spied on. So there are spies in her household, and he orders investigations into her conduct on occasions. And there's a rumor that she's given birth at one stage, and so the king looks into it. So she's certainly not an entirely independent person. So there is this dark side as well, and that she's being watched, and she is seen as a political figure. But in general, she gets on very well with Henry.
Sorry. Do you think in, again, post-marriage, do you think she was a massive political player, or do you think she just wanted a quiet life?
Yeah, I mean, I think she's not a political player by choice. Actually, she does. I mean, it said she appears at court every day wearing a new dress, for example. She does enjoy herself, and probably does quite like the single life, because no one's in control of her. She's a lot richer than she would have been in Cleves. So I think she's not a political player by choice. It's really by virtue of her position, because she's Henry's ex-wife. When Henry dies, she loses that kind of leverage, if you like, because actually nobody really cares whether she says she's Henry's wife or not. She did actually at one stage attempt to overturn the annulment, and that's probably to obtain a widow's jointure rather than her annulment settlement, which would allow her to return to Cleves, but it doesn't work out. So she does have involvement politically. Under Edward VI, they have very much have designs on her property, and actually she starts to lose her residences. She loses Richmond, she loses Bletchingley. But she does attempt to stand up for herself with the Royal Council. She's in a better position under Mary. Mary is quite close in age to Anne. They've always got on, and Anne's actually quite prominent in Mary's coronation procession and relatively prominent at court. But they then also fall out over Wyatt's rebellion because there are claims that Anne is involved in it, although there's no evidence that she was.
In this time, sorry, would you say that Anne became more fluent in English? You know, she started to become more English than German.
Yeah, she's completely fluent in English and quite quickly, not during her marriage, but within, by the end of 1540, she's looking pretty fluent, and she becomes completely fluent, and her letters are fluent in English. So she does become an Englishwoman to a large extent. She's certainly never able to go home. She does retain contact with her German family. In fact, she tries to persuade Queen Mary to marry her brother's brother-in-law, for example. So she's clearly still wedded to her birth family. So, she's both German and English by the end of her life, I would say.
When Henry VIII dies, was she treated well by her ex-stepson, or was it a bit more difficult?
Yeah, no, she's not treated well under Edward VI at all. In fact, Edward tries to marry her off to Thomas Seymour at the start of his reign, which I think is probably to just get rid of her. But yeah, no, she's not treated well. Nobody tops up her pension anymore, so she's struggling for cash. She loses Richmond Palace, she loses Bletchingley, which are her London residences, so that's a problem for her. So no, she doesn't get on well with Edward or his council.
Once Edward dies, was she a supporter of the ascension of Mary, or was she later Jane Grey?
Mary, as far as we can see, there's no evidence at all that she supports Jane Grey. There's no evidence of what she was doing at that period, but I'd be surprised if she supported Jane Grey. She seems on friendly terms with Mary. And Mary later lends her Chelsea Manor, where Anne will actually die as well. So they do have a bit of a rough patch during Mary's reign, but I think in general, she's always on friendly terms with Mary. In her will, she leaves Mary her best jewel, for example.
Was Anne close with Elizabeth, Henry VIII's youngest daughter?
Yes, she was. So Anne very much is. I mean, Elizabeth, of course, loses her mother when she's only two, but actually she has this absolute wealth of mother figures. During her childhood, she has a governess, Kate Ashley. She has Catherine Parr, her final stepmother. But Anne of Cleves is also another one of these figures that really kind of becomes a mother to her to some extent. And the two of them are very close. It's likely that Anne gets into trouble during Mary's reign because she's known to be closely associated with Elizabeth. And the pair ride together in Mary's coronation procession, for example, in the same carriage. She leaves Elizabeth her second best jewel in her will, but she does seem to have been very close to her and liked spending time with her.
Do you think Anne was involved in the Wyatt's Rebellion?
There's no evidence that she was. There are suspicions by the Spanish that she is, but there's no evidence at all. And I think probably not. I think, yes, she's fond of Elizabeth. Elizabeth was also suspected of involvement in Wyatt's Rebellion, and nothing could be proved against her. She does seem to have known about it in advance. So, no, I think there's no evidence. And I think the government don't find any evidence either that Anne's involved, but it does sour relations with Mary.
In going to Anne's final days, what do you believe her cause of death was?
No idea. And that's always the case, almost always the case with historical figures. She dies really young. Although she's the last survivor, she's only at the start of her 40s. So she dies really young. So she's probably 41 when she dies, maybe 42. But I don't know. There's just nothing. We don't have any account of her symptoms. I mean, it's obviously not old age. She's well enough to make a will. It's quite a detailed will. But yeah, I mean, something.
apart from the two jewels that she gave to Mary and Elizabeth, what else was included in her will?
So she makes a lot of bequests to her servants. She makes a lot of bequests to the poor of the places that she's lived as well. So the poor of Hever receive money, for example. So she's quite generous in her will. But it's quite clear that her stepdaughters are important to her.
Where is Anne buried?
So Anne is the only one of the six wives to be buried in Westminster Abbey, and has quite a nice tomb. Her funeral was paid for by Queen Mary, who also paid for her tomb. So she's certainly got the grandest burial place of any of the six wives.
I had the privilege of seeing it a week ago, yes, tomorrow, and I got a bit emotional actually because it's the only one of his wives to be buried there, and it's
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, you kind of you would expect, I mean, Catherine of Aragon and Mary wanted her mother to be moved to be buried with her in Westminster Abbey, but it never happened. Obviously, Jane Seymour could have been buried there. She was never in disgrace, but Henry picked Windsor. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting that only Anne is there amongst this royal burial ground. I think it's quite fitting because, of course, she was a Queen of England.
absolutely. What do you think is important to remember about Anne?
I think there are a few things. I think there's a bit of a trend quite often to see her from a modern viewpoint and to not necessarily view her as the 16th century woman that she was. And actually, I think she's more remarkable as within the context of the 16th century, because as I said, to be repudiated by your husband is awful, worst thing that can happen. But she actually thrives following it. And there's quite a lot of adversity. People take advantage of a single woman. Her status is very ambiguous. Her money and her property are seen as fair game under Edward VI, but she's still able to make a success of it. And I think that's really important. But I think it is important to view her through the guise, not of this woman who's like, yes, Henry has divorced me, let's go, but really a woman who has this awful, awful thing happen to her. She's in a foreign country, she doesn't speak the language, and yet she succeeds and she does build a life for herself and quite a good life at that. So I think that's really important.
I got to thank you for coming on to talk about Anne of Cleves. I'm a huge fan of your work, so I'm very grateful for you to coming on. But firstly, I would like to ask a Tudor question, but have you got a Tudor pet peeve?
Ooh, Tudor pet peeve. That's a tricky one. Oh, I don't, I mean, partly it's calling Anne of Cleves a Protestant, if I'm honest. Well, I mean, at the moment I'm working on a study of Jane Seymour, an academic book. And one of my pet peeves about Jane Seymour is that she gets portrayed in opposition to Anne Boleyn all the time. So people sort of say, Anne Boleyn is a Protestant queen, so Jane Seymour is the Catholic queen. And, actually she needs to stand for herself. So I think partly it's attitudes to Jane Seymour, because she tends not to be most people's favourite wife either. And actually she's lovely. So I think maybe it's the way people treat poor old Jane Seymour.
Yes, Jane's definitely a figure that's not been, history's not been kind to Jane.
No, it hasn't. I'm hoping that my book will kind of unpick that a bit. But yeah, so I think, yeah, poor old Jane. People are mean to her.
So, would you say Jane Seymour's your favourite Tudor to research then?
She's interesting. There's a lot to be found. I mean, there are huge gaps as well, and I'm being honest about it in the book. I'm saying, actually, I don't know this. There's a huge gap in her life. But actually, you can find some really interesting stuff. She's a very shrewd businesswoman, which I don't think has been brought out before, for example. And there's a lot more nuance to her religious faith. So I think, yeah, I mean, she's kind of, to some extent, uncharted territory, and that's quite good fun. And particularly trying to unpick the myths about her. And I've been guilty of promulgating Jane Seymour myths as well. I'm not innocent in this, but I'm trying really to take her back to basics and tell, say this is what we know about Jane.
Have you got a favourite Tudor book, fiction or non-fiction?
Oh, that's tricky. Well, obviously mine. Oh, I don't know. Oh, this could be awkward. I know lots of the other historians. Hi, everyone. Yeah, no, this could be awkward. Oh, I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily it's my favourite now because things have moved on, but I think I'm going to say Antonia Fraser's Six Wives of Henry VIII, because that again is one of those kind of entry books for me, if you like. It got me into it. I was reading this as, as a kid, and actually really got me interested. So I'm going to go with that one. It's an absolute, it will never leave my shelf. Things have moved on quite a bit, which is understandable, of course. It's 30, 35 years old. It's of its time, but I think it's it was the first kind of really modern attempt to try to display the six wives as individuals, because they do get compared to each other, like with Anne and Jane, and actually to try and pick out their stories. I certainly prefer it to David Starkey's Six Wives, which is a fabulously detailed book. But then you look at Jane Seymour, and she's got about 14 pages. Actually, if you're going to do a book on the Six Wives, you need to do something about each of them. So I'm going to go with Antonia Fraser's fabulous book. The caveat is, of course, it is a little out of date these days, but a really, really great entry into the Six Wives.
No, that's a really good choice. It's a stellar choice. I think my first staple book was Alison Weir's Six Wives of Henry VIII.
Yeah, another really good book, looking at what women as individuals, which is really great to see.
Have you got any advice for budding historians?
Ooh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, keep going, keep researching, try and find new things, try and think about new interpretations. And as I always say to my students, when you're reading secondary materials, so articles written by other people and books, look for their argument, because everybody has an argument. And you need to work out what they're actually saying behind the facts about the history. So yeah, but yeah, just keep going, keep researching, and find what you're interested in, because it's really, really interesting.
And that is a wrap. Thank you so much, Dr. Norton, for coming on my podcast to talk about Anne of Cleves.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.